And here we go with what you need to know about today.
Same strategy that Israel has for years. No strategy. In this chaos, the military does what it does the best. Simply hammer the nail.
A $13 billion US dollar flagship and nearly daily sewage breakdowns below deck. Many crew members are angry.
No, the objects are horrible for the Navy.
Yeah.
Horrible for the Navy, horrible for the United States military. This is the most advanced ship in the world, supposed to be.
Yeah.
But it's not designed to fight a war.
The United States trying to project power, you know, 5,000 or 6,000 miles from its shores, which means Iran has geographical advantages that cannot be overcome.
Cannot be overcome. Oh boy, we have got a special report today with important guests who've flown all the way from the United States. Right here in front of this big map, we're going to share with you a very American perspective as we break down the war in Iran here on the Sanchez Effect. Let's do this. Hello again, everybody. I'm Rick Sanchez. So with President Trump and the people who chose to attack Iran, a country that did not attack them, have done is having really severe consequences. If you game theory this out, right, this does not end in a result that is in any way good for the United States of America. And the signs are plentiful, geopolitically, economically, militarily, and I'm going to take you through them. Let's talk about some of those signs. Here's one right now. Reuters is now confirming just within the past 24 hours, and they've talked to officials in Bahrain who are members of the government, that it was indeed a Patriot interceptor, not an Iranian missile, a Patriot interceptor on March 9th that blew up a residential area that injured some 32 people, and a lot of those people are going to die. Wait, you're probably saying to yourself, right? Weren't these U.S. interceptors supposed to protect the people of Bahrain and the other countries in the GCC? So what happened? And by the way, not just now, what happens moving forward? Will countries like Bahrain rely on the U.S. in the future militarily? Will they trust the United States strategically, right? Look at this story. This is about the Gerald R. Ford. This is a story about low morale, bad plumbing, and even sabotage.
A $13 billion US dollar flagship and nearly daily sewage breakdowns below deck. Sailors work 19-hour shifts to keep 650 toilets running. Many crew members are angry, one admits.
Fire on board the USS Gerald R. Ford started in the ship's main laundry spaces. 600 sailors are without beds. More than 200 sailors were treated for smoke inhalation.
Some serious problems with their sewage plumbing. So the best American warship that came, the American soldiers had a tough time going to the toilet.
One sailor on board the Ford told the Journal that many crew members are angry and upset, with some saying they want to leave the Navy at the end of the deployment. The sailor said she was strongly considering quitting herself.
What a mess. And that's militarily. I want to talk to you now about the United States, the West in general's economic supremacy, right? Banking, trade, currency. Look what the Central Bank of Kazakhstan, of all places, just did. Are they starting a trend? Maybe. Kazakhstan has just become the very first country to truly start betting against fiat currency. Full throttle. They're actually having their central bank go out and buy Bitcoin. Right. Crypto, as they call it. $350 million worth. Why? Well, because central banks around the world are losing faith in the fiat system of currency. In other words, I mean, let's just call it what it is, right? They're losing faith in the dollar. Why? Well, the U.S. right now, because of this war, is about to owe $40 trillion. That's the debt, and it's gone up because of this war, about another trillion since Mr. Trump took office. Now let's talk about the U.S. relationship with Israel, right? It's been there forever. Nobody ever really much thought about it inside the United States. But now it's turning out to be possibly the worst merger from a public relations standpoint in like 100 years. See, the United States used to be admired, or at least respected, by most of the people around the world. But this Iran war is making a lot of people hate the United States almost as much as they hate Israel for what Israel has been doing in Gaza. Again, not good optics. So ask yourself, if you're an American, right, is Israel worth following? Is Israel worth fighting for? After all, we're told it's in our interest as Americans. And we're also told that Israel is a great country with really smart leaders who have everything figured out. They have calculated everything to the last imaginable step, right, toward a victory somehow. Have they? No. No. I want you to listen to something. Listen to what this high-ranking former leader of the Israeli Knesset just told Tucker Carlson. He says the Israeli government, his word, clueless.
I listened to you very carefully in the last couple of weeks, and the way you try to conceive the Israeli strategy from Netanyahu's 40 years life mission to the greater land of Israel, biblically speaking, or messianic eschatological one. And I envy you that you really believe that we have something like that. Okay? It doesn't work that way. The same strategy that Israel has for years, no strategy. In Israel, in many, many cases, the compilation of many tactics sometimes assemble into a de facto strategy, but otherwise nothing. Bottom line is nobody has a clue. And in this chaos, the military does what it does the best, simply hammer the nail.
Hammer the nail. So the U.S. is being led by a tiny country's politicians who are clueless. In fact, Mr. Abraham goes even further in helping us understand the irrationality of the, what he calls the irrationality of the Israeli mindset. He says it's all about, for Israel, he says it's all about looking for a way to destroy other countries around it. And somehow, he explains, it all has to do with Hitler.
Every decade we have a new Adolf Hitler. And since everybody is the arch enemy, there is only one solution to this one enemy: removal. And therefore, when you ask me what is the Israeli political echelon, forget about the people in the street, the political echelon approach toward any kind of resolution, whatever it is, it's not a dialogist one. Now, it is not just about Netanyahu, which is a case by himself. When you look at what is allegedly called opposition in Israel, they simply compete with the government who is more aggressive, who is more as if resilient, who has more so-called creative solution to the enemy we have to demolish and obliterate.
So if Israel is clueless and is using bad practices, then my God, what are we, right? Which leads us to this, where we are right now. Think about it. Just within the past 72 hours, right, since I've been keeping count, the Trump administration has talked about boots on the ground, but then they deny that there's going to be boots on the ground, so said the president in a conflicting statement. They have threatened to destroy Iran's energy grid. He did, Mr. Trump did, but then he chose not to, right? It has talked about sending Marines into this area, right? But then hasn't explained where, for what, why they're going. I mean, it's also said that the Strait of Hormuz that you see right there behind me is still essentially open. But it's not. It's not. So it's like, you know, here's another thing. Neither the American people nor Congress have yet been told to this day what actually was the imminent threat that was posed by Iran. Do you know? I mean, instead, my gosh, I can think of at least four or five different competing narratives that have been shared with us about why we went in. You know what they are, or you've heard them all, including this one.
We stood and waited for that attack to come first. Before we hit them, we would suffer much higher casualties. And so the president made the very wise decision. We knew that there was going to be an Israeli action. We knew that that would precipitate an attack against American forces. And we knew that if we didn't preemptively go after them before they launched those attacks, we would suffer higher casualties and perhaps even higher those killed. And then we would all be here answering questions about why we knew that and didn't act.
So here's the Secretary of State essentially saying the only reason we went to Iran was because Israel wanted to go into Iran and we had to go in because they wanted to go in. So where are we right now when it comes to this war? Is it winnable? And what happens if it's not? We're lining up right here in front of the big map to bring you this conversation with two people I very much respect. Scott Ritter, former weapons inspector, who, as you know, tried to warn the world once about the Iraq lie. And Garland Nixon, a very well-known and respected broadcaster here in, I mean, there in the United States. Let's do this. You know, this is something I've been wanting to do for some time. I think it's important. This is a conversation that we are going to have now, as promised, really between three guys who are Americans. You know, it's our country that's very much involved in this right now. Many would argue, in fact, responsible for this. So what are the implications of it, not just with what's going on today, but perhaps even long term? So as you know, joining me now, Garland Nixon. He's one of the best known radio hosts in the United States. I've been listening to him for years and I've worked with him for years on a lot of different shows. And of course, Scott Ritter, who really needs no introduction. He's probably one of the best known persons who speaks to these types of things, not just with this incident, but he's been doing it, obviously, around the time of the Iraq War. So I think this is a perfect opportunity for us to catch up on this situation. And we're going to start, gentlemen, with the latest news, the breaking news, which is there appears to be some kind of talk about the U.S. and the Iranians sitting down and trying to negotiate this out. Now, let me show you why this story or where this story came from. If we could go to cut eight, guys, let's put this up so people can see. The Iranian foreign minister secretly informed Witkoff of a supreme leader's agreement to negotiate with the United States. So what they're saying here is that the supreme leader has given the go-ahead for people inside of Iran to negotiate with Mr. Witkoff. Some people would wonder why you would negotiate with Mr. Witkoff since he was the one they were negotiating with when they got bombed. But that's perhaps another point that we're going to be talking about. The question is this story real? And there are some issues. And I'll start with you, Garland. The issue is this story is not coming from inside Iran. It's not even coming from the United States. It's not coming from Europe. It's coming from Israel. The sourcing on this story is from Israel. You say what?
Well, this contradicts everything we've heard from Iran since the beginning of the conflict, where they've said that they won't negotiate with the United States because of every time they've negotiated with them, they've been attacked. So that certainly seems logical.
Oh, yeah, and there's that.
Yeah, so it's coming out of Israel at this point. You know, that, and that's one of the issues with this conflict. It's hard to believe anything that we hear that doesn't come, to be quite frank, that doesn't come from the Iranians.
So you don't think the Iranians are really agreeing? You don't buy the story?
No,
at this
I don't.
Point,
I
given what's been reported.
Yes.
I hope it's true.
Yeah, so, as do I.
Yeah.
I would buy it more if it came from one of the Iranians' allies, such as maybe a Russia or China or something like that. Out of Israel, I find
Scott,
it hard to believe.
What do you think?
First of all, I hope it's not true. Because if it's true, it means Iran's capitulated. And if Iran capitulates, that means the United States, who has initiated an illegal war of aggression, wins. I'm American. I like to win.
Yeah, but hold on. Let me stop you there. I'm going to disagree with you. What if the United States, I'm not saying this has happened, what if the United States, we're going to remove all of the sanctions and we're going to pay repatriation for all of the things, reparations, pardon me, for all the damage that we have done?
You think Donald Trump's going to do that? You
no.
think Donald Trump's going to articulate
I did.
Going into a midterm election where, you know, peace is strength, I'm the strongest man in the world, I'm the baddest man in the world, and suddenly he's going to say, no, we got our butts kicked, I'm going to do everything the Iranians said I have to do.
No.
There's no... This isn't a real story. What this is a continuation of the Israeli game of trying to bring down the Iranian regime. You know what happened this morning when this story broke? Mm-hmm. The streets of the Iranian cities today are filled with hundreds of thousands of people, demonstrators, not saying death to Khomeini, saying do not negotiate.
Yeah.
The Iranian people will not allow this to happen. I've spoke to an Iranian journalist and said we will rip our government apart if they negotiate with the Americans. There's so much hatred for Americans right now.
But you're onto something here, because what's interesting is I was there, you know, and there was a lot of people in the government, a lot of the people who live in Iran who were angry at their government, and they should be angry at their government. Their economy sucks. It's horrible. And in many ways, the government had not handled a lot of things well. And I talked to government officials, and I said, you guys have made a lot of mistakes. They go, I know we have. You're right. But it wasn't to the point where it was out of control. That sentiment now has depreciated. As a matter of fact, you don't see that so much. No. The people who were angry at the government are now less angry at the government because of what the United States has done. Am I wrong?
So many people have died because of this war that Iran did not start. Iran, you know, did not want this war. So many people have died. So much damage has been done that the Iranian people have crossed a threshold where they're saying the sacrifice has already been made. So don't disgrace the sacrifice. You have Israel on the ropes. Get Israel down, get America out, and then and only then can you begin to discuss. But any compromise will be bad. And that's why I don't believe the Iranian government's doing it. This is an Israeli disinformation campaign designed to create tension within Iran, and it's succeeding.
Yeah. Well, Israel's kind of trying to help Mr. Trump not look ridiculous, because in the last couple of days, he has said a lot of conflicting things. I mean, the Gulf is open, but the Gulf is closed. We're sending in the Marines, but we're not going to have boots on the ground. I don't want to talk to the Iranians, but the Iranians want to talk to me. No, wait, I'm sending Witkoff to talk to them. I mean, all this conflicting information, what are we to take away from this?
Well, you know, if we look at it in a broader sense, if you elect me, I will not go to war with Iran or in the Middle East. So what we're seeing from from a broad perspective and then from a micro perspective here is the same thing, and that is Donald Trump seems to say whatever needs to be said in a given hour or minute, and then he changes it quickly. Again, what did we talk about? The issue of confidence, the issue of trust has completely evaporated. I don't know how anyone in the world could negotiate with the United States other than one of those old money-in-hand deals, you know? Going to have the money up front in order to get a deal.
Scott, this is a big deal for you because you're a Marine, and this really means something to you. When your commander tells you, I need you to go over there and do something because there is an imminent threat to your family or my family or your country, that's a serious command that you're receiving. I want you to take a listen to what Joe Kent told Tucker about whether or not the United States, whether or not an imminent threat even existed prior to this war as a reason for us going in. This is cut one, if you could, Gene, take it.
I think this is key. I mean, this would be more challenging to explain had the Secretary of State, the President, and the Speaker of the House not come out and said that we conducted this attack at this time because the Israelis were about to do so. So that takes away the argument that there was an imminent threat, as in Iran was planning to attack us immediately. That just simply did not exist.
Yeah, so he said that, and then Rubio came out and basically said the same thing. As a Marine, what do you make of that?
Well, to be honest, as a Marine, it just doesn't matter. The two battalions that get ready to deploy, 3-5 and 3-1, we're talking, you know, Dark Horse and the Thundering Third. These are Marine battalions with great histories. We obey orders, lawful orders.
Yeah.
The issue of whether or not there's imminent threat, this is a question of Congress in response to War Powers Act, meaning if the president's going to bypass Congress, there must be an imminent threat that necessitates rapid action. First of all, there's nothing rapid about the deployment of Marine Expeditionary Unit.
Yeah.
We have ships sailing across. These Marines are singularly focused on accomplishing the mission that they're going to be given, to close with and destroy the enemy through firepower maneuver. Not a single Lance Corporal is sitting there going, huh, was there an imminent threat or not? What he's worried about is what's going to happen to the Marine on his left and on his right. And that's the sad thing about this. We have these loyal Americans that are ready to give their life. They have been training for this mission. And we have to ensure that before we send them across the beach, that it's a mission worthy of the sacrifice they will be making. that, you know, what we're doing in Iran right now is not worth a single drop of American blood. And yet we have 4,500 of the finest Americans willing to lay their lives down on the line because they're being ordered to do so. We have to make sure that that order is justifiable.
But here's the thing, guys. I think to a certain extent, even a Marine would start to lose a little bit of confidence in his messenger when they keep seeing conflicting signals, equipment that perhaps doesn't work. Let me give you an example. This is the Gerald R. Ford aircraft carrier, supposedly one of the most state-of-the-art, incredible ships ever made. And this thing essentially has been falling to pieces, and it got to the point where the stories that are coming out is that it was sabotaged by its own crew because they were just sick and tired of being out at sea, and nothing on the ship worked, including the toilets, because they used vacuum toilets instead of regular toilets, which apparently are great on planes, but they don't work on ships. We'll show you first the video of the ship. Put the video up of the ship so folks can see what this thing looks like. It's the most sophisticated aircraft carrier reportedly in the whole world. And now this is the report that's coming out. This is 3A. This is the report that's coming out all over the world now about what's going on with this ship. Let's play that.
A $13 billion U.S. dollar flagship and nearly daily sewage breakdowns below deck. Sailors work 19-hour shifts to keep 650 toilets running. Many crew members are angry, one admits.
Fire on board the USS Gerald R. Ford started in the ship's main laundry spaces. 600 sailors are without beds. More than 200 sailors were treated for smoke inhalation.
Some serious problems with their sewage plumbing. So the best American warship that came, the American soldiers had a tough time going to the toilet.
One sailor on board the Ford told the Journal that many crew members are angry and upset, with some saying they want to leave the Navy at the end of the deployment. The sailor said she was strongly considering quitting herself.
There's more stories like this, but, you know, as Americans, we're looking at this and we're thinking, what the hell's the world going to be thinking of us as what used to be the most dominant power in the world? And, you know, we can't get toilets to work on a ship. Thoughts?
Well, I'll just quickly say, have you ever been below decks in a Marine amphibious ship? We live tightly compartmented life.
Yeah.
That probably smells great compared to the smell that's there. And Marine sergeants would find a way to do PT in the sewage to make the Marines tougher.
But what are the optics of this? You know what
the optics are horrible for the Navy.
Yeah.
Horrible for the Navy. Horrible for the United States military. This is the most advanced ship in the world. Supposed to be.
Yeah.
But it's not designed to fight a war. It's designed to appease a politician. It's designed to appease a defensive. Somebody in the Navy shipbuilding business said, let's upgrade so that we, you know, so we look good, so we can charge more, et cetera. This is about making money for people. Now it deployed.
Yeah, this vacuum toilet system, apparently everybody who's now looking at it saying, who in the hell put that in there? That doesn't work on boats. There's no pressure. And once one goes down, the whole system goes down, right?
Yeah. Yeah, and so now you've got, you know, this, and it's not just that. This was, remember, they did away with steam catapults and went with electric catapults that don't work. Everything about this ship doesn't work. It's a horrible ship. It's a lemon. And then they send it on the longest deployment possible. So you start demoralizing the troops. And this is where, here's where you're right. The moment you give anybody in the military a chance to sit back and reflect, see, they should be launching planes. The only thing those sailors should be thinking about is the launching and recovering airplanes, not about politics. They shouldn't have time to watch TV.
Mm.
They should be launching planes, preparing ordnance, doing their mission.
They say they're bored.
Yeah. Well, they're bored because they're not doing anything.
Yeah. It started off the coast of Venezuela, yeah. And they've been out there floating around all this time. Can I give you another example since we're on this thing about what's going on with the military? Here's another one that's a bit of a shocker. This is the famous F-35, what Fidel Castro called the El Avión Invisible, the invisible plane that the Yankees have, right? F-35, this thing has never, ever been struck by enemy missile, ever. Before. And here it is. This is an F-35 getting hit apparently by an Iranian missile, of all things. Talk about making news. Do we have this shot? Let's see if we can put this up. This is cut 6, by the way. Here it is. You've seen this, right, Garland?
Yes.
I mean, this is what most people would have called impossible, and we're seeing it before our very eyes, just like we're seeing a Patriot system and a THAAD system that's also not working as we were told it was supposed to work. What? Again, what is going on, and what is the message that's being sent around the world?
Well, I think there's something important to look at here, $13 billion. My understanding is that's right around what Iran spends for their military budget. So that's one ship.
I mean, 13, how much, what's that?
The cost of the...
Oh, the F-35.
Yeah, they've $13-20 billion, whatever it is. So what seeing additionally, these planes are like $120 to $170 million each. So what we're seeing is boondoggles. What we're seeing is corporations through money laundering and influence, political influence, who are able to make astronomical profits from the military-industrial complex. And here's the reality.
Which would be fine if it worked.
Right. Well, and here's the reality. They could put out a cardboard picture of a plane or a cardboard picture of a ship for all that matters to them. They just want to make the profit. They're making the profit. One of the other things that's important
this is this conversation we have a lot.
It's critical.
We've had this conversation a lot, you and I, about the military-industrial complex being more important to our Congress and to our president than the soldiers.
Yeah, one of the things that people need to know, I found out when I was working on Capitol Hill, what these companies will do, rather than make that plane or that ship in one place, they'll make a little part of it in every congressional district so they can go to every member of Congress and say, we're putting jobs there. So we see the end result of this money laundering. We see the end result of a system that is not designed to make effective weapons. It's designed to make as much money as possible.
But I've never seen so many cases of this. I mean, you know, think about this for a minute. So the GCC countries, right? I'm talking about Bahrain and UAE and Saudi Arabia and Oman and all these countries are depending on the United States by having military installations there. And the promise is we will take care of you. We're going to protect you. Nothing is ever going to happen to you. And these systems that we're putting here, these THAAD systems and these Patriot systems, they are so highly effective. It's incredible. Well, according to the reporting that's coming out of the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, MIT, is that they're only knocking down about 5% of the rockets and missiles that are being sent by Iran. So are they not working? And now we have this. I'm going to show you something. Look at this. This is cut number... Hold on. Let me put my glasses on so you can see. This is cut number two, Gene, a Patriot missile that apparently misfired. Watch this. 32 people have been injured. I'm sure some of them are going to die because it's serious injuries. This is a Patriot missile in Bahrain that apparently either went the wrong way, missed its target. I don't know. Scott, you can talk to this. And we're seeing a lot of cases of this where the THAAD and the Patriot aren't working as well as we were told they were supposed to work. What is going on again? Rick, what does it mean?
In January of 1991, I was in Riyadh when we were struck by Iraqi Scud missiles. And I went to the top of I was the Scud missile guy, so I'm like, oh, I want to see what Scuds look like. So I went to the top of my housing area. There was a Patriot battery nearby. The first two missiles that cycled out popped up and flew straight over my head, just like that, an impact in the desert over here. The Patriot missile did more damage to the city of Riyadh than Iraqi Scuds did. Patriots did more damage to Tel Aviv than Iraqi Scuds did. The Patriots malfunction all the time because they're bad technology.
Yeah.
It's technology that's derived from a 1970s system that the Army, we're talking about defense industry, wanted to make money. So instead of designing something new, they took something old, added bells and whistles. It didn't work then. It doesn't work now. It's a bad system.
Well, where was the reporting on that? Professor Ted Postol told me the same thing that you just told me. He said, I've been warning the U.S. Congress and anybody who will listen to me, including members of the media, that we need to raise serious questions about the Patriot missile until we get to a point where we really need it. Well, here we are now, and you're telling me this because you know and you're an insider, but the average person out there, I didn't know that the Patriots were so fallible.
Let me make another point back, get to the F-35. The F-35, its radar system, has a Block 4 software update that's supposed to be in. It's an update that allows the F-35 to function to maximum effectiveness in an air-to-ground mode.
Yeah.
When we started this war, we kept all our aircraft away from Iranian air defenses, and we used joint standoff weapons. Mm. So the F-35 didn't penetrate Iranian airspace. It launched these weapons. Now, we've cycled through those. We don't have any more left. We've used them all. Cruise missiles. So now the F-35 has to come in closer to drop its ordnance. But because we have a software malfunction, the F-35 now has to operate in an envelope it wasn't designed to operate in. You want to ask why the Iranians were able to shoot it down? Because the F-35 is flying where it shouldn't be flying. Where it's flying right now, its stealth technology doesn't do it any good. It's being visually acquired by Iranians who are able to visually guide a missile in and hit it. So the Iranians are using the most basic technology to take down an aircraft that is the most advanced technology because our military defense industry failed that pilot.
Do you know what I'm thinking as I hear you saying, this? That we have not caught up with the type of warfare that exists today, that we're still making, and I'll give you an example. I'm just going to stand up for a minute. I'm going to stand up for a minute, Gene. I know you told me to walk slow when I do this, so I'm going to back up and go over here. Look over here at the Strait of Hormuz, right? You see the Strait of Hormuz? I heard the Secretary of Defense or the Secretary of War, Mr. Hegseth, say the other day that we're going to be fine there because we've knocked out the Iranian Navy, he said, and our Navy is superior, and they'll be able to stop anybody from the Iranian side who tries to shoot down tankers or block the Strait of Hormuz. But then you talk to people who really know about this kind of stuff, and they'll tell you, we don't need to be worried about the Iranian Navy. What we need to be worried about are rockets that are going to be shot from anywhere inside this area of Iran right here. So the question isn't one about the Iranian Navy. The question is about some other kind of weaponry that they're going to use, right? Yeah, go ahead.
Do you mind if I walk carefully with you?
No, go ahead. You don't get too close because these guys will...
The ships come in this way, go right around that tip.
Right.
To come out, they have to come up, and they actually sail between two Iranian-controlled islands. That's the only exit channel. So you're going right between two islands where they have the missiles on them. See that coastline there?
Yeah.
Those are mountains. If you take a look at the videos, the ships go by, the mountains, everything's dug in right here. There's a brigade here called the RF Brigade, four battalions, that they're not ships. They have the missiles. They've been training for 20 years to defend this strait. We're going to come in with four amphibious ships.
Right.
All right? As they come in, they won't make it past here. They'll get sunk here. We knew this in 2019.
They'll get sunk here because of
the other missiles. And we knew this. In 2019, the Commandant of the Marine Corps, General Berger, issued the Commandant's guidance. And he said, we can't fight this war anymore. We put all our Marines on one ship. And as we get close in, we're going to get sunk. So we're not even going to... This is the island they want to take.
Yeah.
The Marines aren't even going to get here before they all die.
That's fascinating. And we can come back here now, because here's the point that comes out of all this. The stories we're being told about what we might be able to do, we're not going to be able to do, Garland.
Yeah, because here's the other part. War is not just about technology. There are other factors. What are we talking about now? We're talking about the terrain. Well, it's mountainous, so they can hide all kinds of, even artillery, as thin as that the Straits of Hormuz are, they could literally hit ships with artillery.
This is where the rubber meets the road, right? Because what I think is happening right now, you guys tell me if I'm full of crap on this one. What I think is happening right now is the realization that the Iranians control the game.
Yes.
Because they're deciding how long the Strait of Hormuz stays closed. And we can't stop them from making that decision, as Scott just showed why that's the case. And if we can't stop them from controlling the Strait of Hormuz, it's kind of like game over right now. Trump has to find a way, our president has to find a way to open the Strait of Hormuz. And to do that, he needs to negotiate or talk and say pretty please to the Iranians.
Again, well, yes, because what we're looking at is a country, the United States, trying to project power, you know, 5,000 or 6,000 miles from its shores, which means Iran has geographical advantages that cannot be overcome. There's certain things you can't. I don't care what technology.
So how does somebody
have
not think of this before we got into this? I do not understand. This is the frustrating part of this for me. Again, as an American, I'm thinking, I am a citizen of a country that supposedly has the most sophisticated military system anywhere in the world, and nobody in the Pentagon said, hey, we can't do this. Because if they close the Strait of Hormuz, there's no way we're going to be able to stop them from unclosing it.
Well, everybody in the Pentagon said that.
Yeah.
There's not a person in the Pentagon that didn't say that.
So then why did we do it?
Because Pete Hegseth came in and said, we won't have to do that. The Israelis have told me that they're going to kill Khamenei on day one. We're going to come in with the most massive air power ever seen. We're going to pick 1,000 points on the ground, Rick. And what I'm trying to tell you here is that the numbers of targets weren't because they were good targets. It was because we wanted to hit 1,000 points on the ground a day for a period of time to create the impression of American invincibility. We kill Khamenei, we hit 1,000 points of targets on the ground, and the Iranians quit. And that way we don't have to do any of this. And yet, just so you understand, one of those 1,000 points was at girls' school that should never have been struck.
Yeah, I know.
We struck hospitals, the whole thing. This is the most criminally minded war plan in the history of war plans.
Is it criminal or stupid or both?
Criminal. No, it's, first of all, when you're the Secretary of Defense and you're required by, we have a Law of Warfare Act. If you violate the Geneva Conventions grossly, there's a death penalty.
Yeah.
We have a manual of the law warfare manual. Mm-hmm. We had a directive from 2023 that created a unit that screened targets to make sure we didn't hit civilians. Hegseth came in and said, I'm doing away with all the rules. I'm disbanding that unit. We're going to disregard the Law of Warfare Manual. We want increased lethality. And so when he said we're going to put 1,000 bombs on 1,000 targets a day, he was saying, I don't care what you kill. We kill things and break things, he said. That's what we do. There was intent, criminal intent from the very start. So this was criminal and incompetent. What I don't understand is why the JCS didn't resign en masse. This is a leadership failure on the part of the most senior military officers. And now they're in a situation where they're going to have to try and do something they know they can't do. If we send Marines across the beach and they die, people need to go to jail. If we send the 82nd Airborne in with the Rangers and they die, and they will die, we will not win this fight. The Iranians have been preparing for this fight for 20 years.
Yeah.
We're making it up as we go along.
And by the way, they're Persians, and it's called the Persian Gulf.
Well,
Persian Gulf.
How about this?
I mean, right? I mean,
how about this? This isn't new. In the Pacific Islands in World War II, they would bomb the beaches for literally weeks with 16-inch guns and gigantic bombers. And still, when the Marines would hit the beaches, it would be like a hornet's nest full of Japanese. So we already know that even if you bomb the beaches and do all of that, this was from World War II, it's not going to stop the enemy when they're dug in.
Did you get a chance, and I hope I'm not putting you on, did you get a chance to see my reporting from Iran? Some of the questions.
You
saw me sit down with Harachi a week before the bombs fell. And I sat down, I looked at him, and I finally said to him, I said, I know you really want to negotiate this. I know. He told me, I'm willing to give Trump a better deal than we gave Obama. We really want to do this deal. And I got a sense that he was telling the truth. I think he's an honest guy.
Yes.
I really think he's an honest guy from the time that I spent with him. And then I said this to him. I said, what if the negotiation breaks down? What if the Americans attack? What if the U.S. and Israel attack you? He said, we will do everything that we've seen them do.
Yep. Yeah.
He literally said to me, he said, Rick, we will hit every country in the GCC and we will hit every military installation in this area. Were they not paying attention?
Rick, you know that the...
And they didn't just say it to me.
Right.
They said to everybody.
Yeah. Yeah.
They wrote a letter to the UN.
The second Marine unit that's coming in, the Thundering Third. I mean, I love my Marines, so every unit
is that what they're
tradition.
Called, the Thundering Third?
3-1, Thundering Third. But they are leaving their ports 3 weeks early.
Yeah.
Okay, now, if you've ever been deployed, there's preparation, there's lead-up time. This means that there's training that isn't getting done, logistics isn't getting done. So as they're moving, they're going to be doing things 3 weeks early. This is not a planned event. This is a panicked event. Everything we're doing right now is a panicked reaction to the fact that the Iranians had a plan that they stuck to. Iraqi told you everything they were going to do, there's been no deviation at all. Mm-hmm. They've done everything because they have a plan.
Yeah.
We, on the other hand, have been changing our plan every day for 4 weeks now. And it just shows that we don't know what we're doing. And this is what makes it criminal, because we're going to put Marines across a beach when we don't have a plan for them. We don't know what we're going to do. Why are we going across it? Karg Island is a nothing joint. You see, the president says, I've been told 90% of the Iranian oil comes from that. Now, but not now. It'll come from somewhere else. Karg Island is meaningless. The Iranians will simply let you come in. Look how close is the shore. They're just going to kill everybody that lands there.
But you know, what's really weird about this? Here I am, the three of us, Americans, who just happen to be in Moscow. It's a wonderful, beautiful city, by the way. If anybody ever gets a chance to come out here, super clean and, you know, there's very little homelessness. And there's no drug problems. So it's cool. It's got its own problems, too, by the way, like every other city. But here we are having this conversation about the realities of this. And God, I want it to work out as an American, hopefully for both sides. I don't want to see anybody die. But I come from a country where I watch the news and I see two things. A, the so-called thought leaders, our Congress, our politicians, are not telling people the stories that you and I are, the three of us are talking about here. And neither is CNN or Fox News. They're cheerleading this war. Like, we're winning and we're going to kick their ass and we're going to do this and we're going to do that. And I'm thinking, that's not smart and it's certainly not responsible. Here's Rick Scott. Cut seven, if you got this for us, Gene. This is Rick Scott saying, we had to do this because if we didn't do this, we were just 3 minutes away from being nuked. Watch.
They were getting close to a nuclear weapon. They were building ballistic missiles. If they had the ability to drop them in the United States, they would have. They put our troops are at risk. I don't want to be destroyed by a nuclear weapon. I don't want to be destroyed by a ballistic missile. I don't want my family destroyed or any family in the United States. The president's doing the right thing.
Everybody knows that what he's saying is bull crap. Everybody. I mean, the vast majority of Americans still even know this, despite the fact that they're being fed stories like this on, I think that was what, CNN, where that lady works or whatever. So it's just, I'll tell you, as an American, it frustrates me. I don't care what decisions we make. I just want them to be made earnestly with correct information, Garland.
And this is exactly what they did in Iran. Exactly. Don't let them, the evidence that they have a nuclear weapons program be a mushroom cloud. Condi Rice and Dick Cheney, they're playing the same game over again.
How can they do that, though? The same, you're absolutely right. It's the same language. They have weapons of mass destruction, and tomorrow your son will die.
But that worked because they could easily dominate Iraq. And then now it makes it even more dangerous because when no one knows how bad things are going, when no one knows this isn't working out and we're running out of weapons, et cetera, they get even more panicked when they see the situation going bad. And panic, what we see is it's panic. Panic's not a plan. Panic's what you do when a plan doesn't work.
This is the guy who told the world. You're looking at him. Scott Ritter is the first guy who told the world it's not true. They don't have weapons of mass destruction in the case of Iraq. For you to watch this playing out again, it's just got to be, I mean, you just want to hit your head against a wall, I bet.
Yeah, but you can't. I mean, I respect you and I respect this show, so I keep my language clean.
Yeah, thank you.
I am a person that can anger very quickly, and I'm a Marine. This is beyond frustrating, because what this is an indictment of the American people. It's an indictment. Can you fool me once, shame on me.
Yeah.
Fool me twice, as George W. Bush said, won't get fooled again.
You'll get back.
But the point is, the American people are being fooled again. It's not about being fooled. Being fooled means that you are earnestly trying to learn things. The American people are asleep at the wheel.
Yeah.
We're no longer functioning as a constitutional republic. We have ceased to function the way our founding fathers want us. We have a man who literally said, I am a dictator. A man who says, I don't care about the rule of law. I'm guided by my personal morality. A man who contradicts himself on a daily basis. And the American people aren't going to wake up until there's higher gas prices. They're not going to cry over dead Marines. They're not going to cry over dead soldiers.
Yeah.
But they will cry when they have to pay $4.50 a gallon.
You know, you're right. Lately, I've been watching the coverage. We all do. I'm sure the three of us are constantly watching even the stuff that we don't like Fox and CNN, the way they're covering this. But you're right. You know what I see people talking about? The market. What effect this is going to have on oil, and should I buy more oil? What's it going to do to Brent? What's it going to do to crude? What's going on with the Dow and the S&P 500? These are the conversations. Is my gas bill going to go up? These are the conversations that people are having in America. I agree with him. I think it's somewhat irresponsible. How about those 120 little girls who died? Who's speaking for them?
Well, I can inject some positivity into it, though, and that is that we do have an alternative media space now, people such as you,
yeah.
and then people such as us who are on, you know, various platforms. So we do have an alternative media space. So I can say that that alternative media space is growing, and that kind of makes the mainstream media more desperate. And so they're putting out this propaganda that I guess it works on people who are struggling because they can barely make ends meet and they don't have really time to research. But the alternative media space is growing, and we're seeing an increasing number of people who are starting to ask these legitimate questions.
You mentioned Hegseth and some of the conflicting statements that have been made. Here's an example of the president of the United States lately, who's been hard to figure out where he's going oftentimes. He's trying to explain that it's the Iranians who've been reaching out to him. They're calling us. And so I have Witkoff talking to him. Meanwhile, again, the Iranians are saying, no, that's not true. We're not talking. And by the way, as far as we're concerned, we're going to continue fighting because you attacked us and we don't trust you to negotiate. So that's what the Iranians are saying. Here's Trump just within the last 24 hours at the airport talking about this very issue. And listen to what he says when he's asked this question by the reporter about who he's actually talking to. Which Iranian are you talking to? Listen to what he says.
With an Iran.
A top person. I mean, it's a little tough. They've wiped out everybody. I don't want him to be killed. Okay? I don't want him to be killed.
He says they have wiped out everybody. There's nobody left to talk to. They have wiped out everybody. I'm so confused. Maybe one of you guys can help me. Didn't the United States kill and assassinate all their negotiators?
No, the initial strikes against Tehran were done by the Israelis. The decapitation aspect of this mission, this joint operation, was the Israeli side that was doing it. American intelligence helped. But the president...
So is that what he means?
He means the Israelis killed them, and I don't want to name him because... But we know who he's talking about. He's talking about the Speaker of Parliament. That's the person that is allegedly doing this. But, you know, again...
Why is that happening, do you think?
Well, there's two reasons. One, first of all, the ignorance contained in what he said. He's talking about killing people. Iran is a nation state with institutions. Okay, the resilience from Iran doesn't come from an individual. It comes from a system that will continue to function mm-hmm. even if you kill an individual. And we've killed them all. I don't know, the last time I checked, Mr. President, the president of Iran was still alive. The foreign minister of Iran was still alive. The Speaker of Parliament was still alive. You killed one man and you killed a bunch of generals. You haven't done your decapitation, but even if you did, Iran would continue to function because they, unlike us, are a constitutional republic with systems.
What about this notion, though? If he's saying, let's take him at his word. He's saying, I want to protect this guy because I don't want the Israelis to kill him. It's not us. It's the Israelis who are killing him. And, we, you know, if I say his name, then the Israelis will kill him. Are the Israelis that powerful that the United States is afraid of the Israelis, Garland? And the United States can't control? The United States cannot control what the Israelis do. Which is what that would mean if we take him at his word.
I don't necessarily trust the good cop, bad cop story. You know, I feel like they're on the same team. I don't necessarily trust the story that Benjamin Netanyahu is completely pushing the United States around. I believe the U.S. saw this as an opportunity to take out Iran, and that way they could affect China's ability to access the oil. So I think that there is a, you know, they're playing this game together. But I do think that there is a level of desperation in the White House. I think they want out. They know that it's going bad for them, particularly when it comes to domestic politics. But, you know, some people believe that there's these two separate entities. I'm one of the people that think they're working together and their stories are kind of designed.
A lot of people do.
Yeah.
A lot of people do. Yeah.
Again, we just have to be realistic here and let the evidence speak for itself.
Yeah.
What's taking place right now is one of the most complex strategic air campaigns ever executed in modern history. The amount of aircraft that are sorting in and sorting out. You know, we had the tragedy of two American tankers colliding. They're colliding because we're doing refueling operations nonstop to keep these planes in. It's a joint refueling operation, meaning that the Israeli and American aircraft are being refueled by the same system. We have a joint strike plan. We You don't just fly
airplanes.
Can you
win a war that way? Can you win a war with just the Air Force?
It's no, you can't win it with a war with just the Air Force. But what I'm trying to say is, I mean, you can collapse the Desert Storm was about a strategic air campaign designed to collapse Iraq's ability to resist over time. Mm. We had done a better job studying Iraq. With Iran, four times bigger, they've been preparing for 20 years.
Yeah.
We haven't done a good job. Like I said, we're bombing points on the ground. We're not bombing targets that mean something. But this is a joint operation planned by the Israelis and the United States. This is not a they're doing their thing, we're doing our thing. This is a carefully coordinated military operation where the Israelis and the Americans are sitting in the same command space, coordinating their airstrikes, their targets, refueling. You can't have Israeli aircraft come in and come out and need to be refueled when you have an American packet. So it has to be phased in. As they come out, they get refueled, we come in. And it's all done in coordination, close coordination.
Yeah. So when you're saying Israel, you're saying U.S., and when you're saying U.S., you're saying Israel.
Right, yep.
We've taken the day of stuff, and we've talked about where we are as far as the theater is concerned right now, and we've talked a little bit about the politics. Let's end up with this as we get to the conclusion of this really great conversation with you guys, because you're both so smart, and it's so nice to have this conversation with you. And I'm sure people all over the world are looking at this and thanking you for it. But let's talk about what happens next. And that is, at some point, this is going to end. And when it's over, what's this region going to be like? And what's the United States going to be like? We always call this the hegemony, or whatever the hell that means. Hegemony means that the United States has had, and the West has had, dominion of the world for so long. Does this action by the United States, as some have indicated, devalue that hegemony? Is that part of what's going to happen next?
I think two things. I think the wisdom of having U.S. bases on in your country is going to be revisited by many leaders. Because not only can they not protect you, they can't protect themselves.
Yeah.
And it becomes a liability as opposed to an asset. I think the other thing
That's an important point, though.
As far as the Middle East, I think, particularly with Russia, countries who get their the significant amount of their hydrocarbons and their energy from the Middle East are going to look at it and they're going to say, I want stability, and they're going to try to diversify the areas of the world that they get hydrocarbons from and maybe go to atomic energy, et cetera, because people are going to say, that's effectively a supply chain.
Hmm.
It's a vulnerable supply chain. I have to diversify it. So I think people are going to be looking to diversify their energy worldwide dramatically as fast as they can.
Do you think those GCC states that you just mentioned who feel like they got really crappy protection are going to now be more apt to turn to a China, a Russia, and India, these countries who are a part of BRICS? Or
I think they have to, and Russia is going to be important if we're able to end this thing diplomatically and afterwards, because Russia has relationships, even with Israel, but they have relationships with the Gulf states and Iran. And I think if I'm running one of these Gulf states, I'm on the phone with Russia saying, you're the only ones I know that have the trust diplomatically that can work out a deal.
Yeah. Same question to you, Scott. Where do you think this leaves us?
Well, first of all, I think the United States is in a very bad situation. There is no military solution. And when you lead with the military...
There is no military solution.
There is no military solution.
Wow.
We're not going to win this war. There's nothing we could do to win. To get sufficient forces necessary to project troops on the ground would take 9 months to 13 months. And given what's going on with the price of gas and oil, we'll be bankrupt by that time. And so the United States now not only will have to retreat from the Middle East, but understand we have exhausted our supply of high-end air defense and high-end strike, meaning we can't do this anywhere else. We can't do it in the... We've weakened it. We've emptied everything. It's going to make it prohibitively expensive to rebuild. So America's going to have to go through a complete rethinking of how we project power around the world. But on the economy of this, I agree with Garland. Already you see, for instance, Russia stepping in and filling the contract. And energy isn't about short-term contracts. Energy is about long-term contracts. And Russia's in there filling the gap. But even if we got the Strait of Hormuz flowing, Qatar, one of the top gas producers, 17% of their production capability is destroyed. It's going to take years to bring it up on.
Yep, it's gone.
Kuwait has drawn down their oil fields to maintain them, to avoid destruction. To bring them back up is going to take weeks and months. That's energy that won't be available on the market at a time right now when people are desperate. understand, this isn't about just keeping three square meals on a table. People now around the world have been denied meals for days. Australia's out of diesel. Other nations, South Korea is now net rationing gas. These people are starving for energy. And so, you know, they're going to be desperate for, you know, energy to come flowing in. And if the Middle East can't deliver it, it's going to come from other resources. I think this is the end of those Gulf Arab monarchies who have lived so long based upon the money they make selling energy. You're going to see them go bankrupt fiscally, and then everybody will recognize their moral bankruptcy as well.
Colossal mistakes cause serious consequences.
Yep.
And I think the three of us agree, at least at this point, unless something changes, this is a colossal mistake on the part of our government.
Can I say one thing?
Of course.
Garland's 100% correct. You know, I mean, I know we're in Russia and all this, but this isn't about kissing Russia's bottom.
Yeah.
Russia's the only nation in the world right now that has the combination of economic capabilities and diplomatic capabilities to resolve this situation. China can come in and play cleanup afterwards. You know, China, of course, brought Iran and Saudi Arabia together. But Russia has the ability right now to come in and be the one to broker this peace. There's connectivity between Trump and Putin. There's connectivity between Putin and all the nations here. Iran,
including Iran.
And
especially
Israel.
Iran.
Yeah, and but Israel.
20% of Israel is are Russians.
That's interesting that Mr. Putin has relationships, well, not just Mr. Putin, but essentially the Foreign Ministry of Russia has very close ties and relationships, open relationships with Israel, with Iran, with the United States, with China. Who else can say that? That's a good
just
point.
Russia.
I hadn't thought about that.
And they can provide fertilizer, which is another major issue here that's missing during the spring planting season.
Yeah, only 30% of the fertilizer is coming from that part of the world, so you can only imagine what's going to happen as a result of that. Guys, I really appreciate it. Thank you so much. And I'm sure our viewers appreciate it. This is a really important discussion, and it's nice to get your perspective on this the way we have. Thank you again.
Thank you.
Really, really good stuff. And welcome to Moscow.
Thanks.
So that's it for us. I think it's important, once again, to have these types of conversations. And most of all, I would like to encourage you to share these conversations when you see them, because you're not going to have something where it's as transparent as this conversation has been. You're certainly not going to get this from the BBCs or the CNNs or the Fox Newses of the world. So go to Spotify, go to BitChute, go to any of the places, including X, where you'll see this content, and maybe you can share it with somebody else. In the meantime, I want to say to you from the bottom of my heart, thank you so much, seriously, for allowing us to come into your homes. I'm Rick Sanchez. This is The Sanchez Effect, and we'll be looking for you next time. Good night.